ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I think the whole industry is in shock. Nobody expected anything like this.
There's not going to be any fish, so the little bit that is caught in the South Coast is going to catch an enormous price tag.
Commercial and recreational fishers in WA are processing the announcement of strict bans limiting fishing in Perth and large parts of regional Western Australia. We'll have more on that story soon. And women in regional Queensland are waiting 4 to 9 months for diagnostic mammograms, compared to 3 to 4 weeks in metropolitan areas.
When we see barriers for women to be able to access screening and prevention and all of these preventative health needs, it can delay things. And the problem for what we see is that if there are delays, then breast cancers will not be picked up early.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, concerns have been raised that a new fishing ban in Western Australia is likely to affect the price of fish. The dramatic change to fishing in WA waters up and down the coast was announced this week with the aim of protecting what's called demersal fish stocks. Our reporter Lisa Herbert has more.
Demersal fish are the fish that live and feed near the bottom of the sea, species like jewfish, red emperor and pink snapper. The WA government's fisheries data shows that stocks are in trouble, and to help them recover, commercial fishers will be permanently banned from catching demersal fish in one of the state's fisheries, with 50% catch reductions to be implemented in most of the state's other fisheries. Minister Jackie Jarvis.
So the missing piece of the puzzle for me was in August when I received the recreational fishing survey, which is done every 3 years, which showed that we were catching more fish than we'd anticipated. And there has always been trying to get that balance between recreational and commercial and charter fishing. I guess I've bitten the bullet and said the commercial sector is no longer viable in this particular region. We're 15 years into a 20-year management plan. The reality is the science now shows we haven't done enough.
The West Coast fishery, which stretches from Kalbarri on the mid-north coast to Augusta in the far south, will be permanently closed to commercial fishing for demersal species from December 16. There are 64 licence holders operating 41 vessels that will be affected by these new restrictions. The WA government will buy back the fishing licences of those commercial operators. Among them is Anthony Hasselwood, who operates across 3 fisheries from Bunbury to Esperance. He says he's been blindsided by the move and predicts that WA consumers will be the ones who will suffer from the bans.
The fisheries that affected the most for me are the West Coast line fishery and the southern demersal longline fishery, which have been completely deleted. So that's probably 90% of where our fish comes from, which is chucked straight into the local market and the metro area. So it's feeding a lot of people. And it's really, really disappointing that that's what they've chosen to do, given that it could have been so surgically dealt with, and instead they've just used a machete and chopped the whole thing away, which is just so disappointing. And they're trying to save 1 or 2 species of fish, and in doing so they have taken every other species of fish off the table as well, which is just so ridiculous. There's a lot of fish out there which is like nanigai, which are a staple for us, and they're feeding a lot of people in Western Australia and around the country that came in at a low risk, so they're basically no risk at all. And we can now no longer access those for anybody. And they could be targeted so simply, and they are nowhere near where jewfish and pink snapper live.
Like the other operators affected by this significant fishing ban, Mr. Hasselwood will receive a government support package. But he says it's not about that.
Sort of we're poking through the rubble at the moment. We will still be able to operate in the South Coast and catch some of these fish that people love to eat. However, given the scarcity that will now exist because nobody's allowed to catch them in the West Coast, or you know, even the Norwest trawl and the West Coast shark fishery is now shut, there's not going to be any fish. So the little bit that is caught in the South Coast is going to catch an enormous price tag for businesses to remain viable, which is more than likely going to see local venues shut out from it. They're not going to be able to access it, which is disgusting in my opinion.
Doug Gibson has been a commercial fisher off the Kimberley and Pilbara coast since 1993. He told Vanessa Mills, like other commercial fishers, the ban will see his annual catch halve, which will drive up prices.
I think the whole industry is in shock. Nobody expected anything like this. The minister sort of claims it's the biggest reset in WA's fishing history, and it is that. But you know, from my own business point of view, I've had my access reduced by 50%. Between the Pilbara and the Kimberley, we'd be supplying 700 to 800 tonnes per year into, and it's all exclusively West Australian into Perth. So that fish goes all over Western Australia.
So if you're only going to be catching, say, for example, 350 tonnes next year, what's that going to do to the price of fish?
I think the demand for fish is going to go through the roof based on very, very limited supply. The state's fish supply has just been cut by two-thirds at the stroke of a pen, and that is going to have consequences.
Finn's Seafood supplies produce to about 250 restaurants across WA. Co-owner Phil Clark was shocked with the news of the fisheries ban.
It catches a lot of the lower value fish that really end up on people's plates at home. So, yeah, I think it's going to affect a lot of businesses, not just ours, but, yeah, we're going to have to be dynamic and source other fish. And it's quite interesting timing that we're going to have this closure, because in July next year, we're getting cool country of origin labelling. So when you go to a restaurant, you're going to have I for imported, A for Australian, and M for mixed. You know, that in itself was going to raise fish prices, and now we're having a huge reduction to our overall catch, and which is going to put upward pressure on prices. So it's scary to think where prices might end up.
Recreational fishers are also affected. The West Coast fishing zone will be a no-go zone for a while to allow for the protection of spawning fish. That will reopen in September 2027. And wreck fishers on a boat will have to report any demersal fish that they catch via an app. Minister Jackie Jarvis again.
If we had real-time reporting, it would give us clearer data earlier and allow us to make decisions about reopening or closing at an earlier stage. With the ending of commercial fishing in the West Coast, we also lose the data on their take. So having real-time reporting coming in 2026 is important. I guess this is about citizen science. You know, we're really going to need that recreational fishing data so we can make decisions.
WA Greens Oceans spokesperson Sophie McNeil acknowledged the difficulties businesses would face, but said the fishery closures were needed to prevent some species from disappearing forever. Meantime, WA Nationals fisheries spokesperson Kiralee Waugh said while it was important to protect fish populations, the commercial sector had been given little consultation and time to adjust.
We have to say that the jewfish is the winner here. When we come to managing fisheries, it's very, very important that we do look towards what is going to be the future. We want to make sure future generations can fish for this stock. However, we do have some questions around the consultation that has occurred to result at these particular decisions. We also know that there is a compensation package that's now on the table and a transition package. This is news. This is news to all of the industry that is there, and they've got a month to get their businesses in order. Is that sufficient time?
That's WA Nationals fishery spokesperson Kiralee Waugh finishing that story from Lisa Herbert.
ABC Australia Wide.
And staying in WA, one of the state's most remote communities has narrowly avoided disaster, rescuing a crucial food and supply delivery after the truck delivering it broke down. Punmu, 1,300 kilometres northeast of Perth, relies on a bulk delivery every year to keep the community supplied over the wet season, when cyclonic rains can close the only road into town for weeks. Punmu staff spend 15 hours repairing the triple trailer delivery truck, carrying $400,000 worth of supplies, after the road's rough conditions damaged its rear axle. It's reignited calls for more state and federal funding to maintain the East Pilbara's road network. Charlie McLean has this story.
Spluttering along a remote dirt road in Western Australia's Pilbara, this truck is pulling precious cargo. Almost 5 months' worth of food and supplies are bound for the small Aboriginal community of Punmu, 1,300 kilometres northeast of Perth. It's cyclone season in northern WA, and if heavy rains flood this road, the community can be cut off for weeks or even months. But something's gone wrong. The truck has missed its Sunday morning arrival time, and Punmu Community Coordinator Edith Costello sends one of her staff out to investigate.
Gary came back with the bad news that the truck's rear axle had broken, and I realised that at the time we had to get together and make a plan. There isn't really anyone to call for help out here.
With $400,000 worth of food and supplies inside, there's no time to waste. Edith sends out their local mechanic, who does some temporary repairs and ditches the trailers so the truck's driver can take it slowly back to the workshop in town.
Meanwhile, staff were flattening and trying to harden the road section that had given away, in the hope that we could get the truck fixed and get back to retrieve our trailers.
Gary Cairn usually manages Punmu's finances, but on Sunday he's got something more important to do. He spends hours ferrying diesel to the stranded trailers so the meats inside can remain frozen. He says working in remote communities is all about adapting on the fly.
It's really a matter of, if you see a job that needs doing, you've just got to have a crack at it.
Back at the workshop, the town mechanic removes the truck's left-hand wheels and gets to work grinding down parts and welding them back in place. After 5 hours, the truck is ready to come back and collect the trailers. Finally, at 6 p.m. Monday night, the final pallets are unloaded.
Seeing all the goods loaded into the warehouse and into the freezer at the end of the day yesterday was a fantastic outcome.
The incident has reignited debate about whether enough is being done to maintain roads in the remote East Pilbara. The local shire has been pleading for state and federal support for months as it struggles to maintain roads across an area bigger than Victoria. It estimates it needs almost $300 million to resheet worn-out dirt roads and repair damage from last year's Cyclone Zelia. Edith Costello says vehicles are regularly being damaged on the Punmu Road.
We've had a car roll over, we've had vehicles lose wheels, we've had engines with cracked engine mounts. It is a very difficult road to drive, and no matter how careful you are.
She wonders why the state government can't seal the road and others like it, but can find $60 million to give Gina Reinhardt's Hancock Iron Ore, which is currently sealing a road between two of its mines in the same region.
She should have plenty of money. Why the government is putting money into that road while neglecting other roads, which are vital routes. The route through our community goes straight to Alice Springs.
The issue has attracted attention from state politicians on opposite ends of the spectrum. The Greens' Sophie McNeill and the Nationals' Julie Freeman have both visited Punmu this year to call for more state funding. Ms McNeill says the community rescue is an incredible story, but it shouldn't have been necessary.
Remote communities are forced to deal with atrocious conditions with not enough help from the state or the federal government, and this urgently needs to change, particularly as we know we're heading into the wet season when people will get cut off, when the roads will be worse than ever.
A WA government spokesperson said $11 million had been given to the East Pilbara Shire in road maintenance grants over the last 3 years, including $700,000 for the Punmu Access Road.
Charlie McLean reporting there from the Pilbara.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
The mining of opals will be allowed to continue in one of Queensland's newest national parks. Originally a cattle station, Vergemont Station isn't far from Winton in northwest Queensland. It covers an area that's larger than the ACT and was bought by the Queensland government about 18 months ago. Hannah Walsh has been covering this story. Hannah, why was Vergemont Station made a national park?
The government identified that land as pretty significant for several species and also to protect Indigenous cultural heritage. So in April last year, the state government bought Vergemont and two other neighbouring properties to turn into national park because it's a key habitat for endangered species like the night parrot, the yellow-footed rock wallaby. It also sits on the headwaters of the Lake Eyre Basin, which is one of Queensland's most important inland river catchments, and contains 34 different regional ecosystems. So between the three properties, they want to create a protected areas corridor for all these reasons. And in 2023, the Queensland government also made a funding commitment of over $260 million to expand and better manage protected areas. So this happened after that, and then there's since been a change of government in Queensland, but this purchase and transition into national park has carried over from the Labor government to the LNP government.
So what then has been the opal mining history on the station?
On Vergemont Station, there's been miners out there with camps and claims mining for generations. In 1991, the state government declared a chunk of land, including Vergemont, for opal miners to mine on, and that's referred to as Restricted Area 257. Last year, at the time of purchase, there were 60 active mining tenures and 80 sort of sub-blocks under exploration on the station. And the opal that's found, the Boulder opal, is sold overseas and contributes significantly to the local economy in the town of Winton. The local council commissioned a report where they found Boulder opals contribute $14 million to the local economy. And there's miners out there that you meet that have been mining out there for 30 years, and it's been passed down from their dad and their dad before that. So there's a significant mining history on Vergemont.
So what has the state government had to say about the coexistence of conservation and mining operations?
I think it's still sort of being discussed and processed as this transition takes place. But as I mentioned before, since the purchase of the land in April 2024, there was a change of government. And it took that 18 months for negotiations between landholders, miners, even the Environment Department with the Resources Department on how these two things can coexist. But the Environment Department wanted to clarify that the restricted area for opal mining won't be classified as national park. So that will sit on its own, and then the national park will surround that section of land that they've classified as okay to keep opal mining in. But as to how exactly they will manage it and the two will coexist, we're still trying to find out a bit more information about that as time goes on.
So what's then been the reaction from the opal miners?
Some year ago, I went out onto Robbie Vinnicombe's mining claim to talk about what was happening. And he stressed that he was just living in this state of limbo, and he'd put his life's work and time into mining out there. So it was quite a stressful time. So getting to talk to him, he said he was shaking and just couldn't believe the news.
Doesn't matter what business you're in, you need certainty. You need to understand where the legal parameters are and the goalposts stand, so you can make investment in time and capital. Now it's all been sorted out, it's all been brought out in the open, and it's a very, 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 very good outcome, not just for the industry, but for our region. Economic diversity in these regional areas is extremely important. We just cannot rely on a single industry or single two industries. We need diversity, and that ensures our future. For me personally, it means my investment is no longer sitting on a knife's edge. It's a good outcome.
That's Queensland opal miner Robbie Vinnicombe. Now, Hannah, the state government has not only allowed existing miners to keep doing what they're doing, it's extended the area allocated to prospecting. What's behind that move, and does that mean more prospectors could move into the area?
The government announced this week that, as well as that restricted area that they've allowed to continue, that they'll add 155,000 hectares onto that. We're not exactly sure where that will be yet, but yes, miners will be able to apply for claims and leases there to be able to create more opportunities for small-scale mining, opal mining opportunities. And the government said they did a geological survey that showed that that area had great potential for opal mining, which was why they allocated that area that will sit outside of the national park.
And so just finally, Hannah, as for the management of the park, I understand it's yet to be named. Will there be rangers in place, and will it be open to the public?
Yeah, the Environment Department have confirmed they've hired new rangers to manage Vergemont Station, or formerly Vergemont Station, what will now be the national park. But as to what will be accessible to the public, if they'll be building low-key camping facilities or anything like that, we just don't know yet. So we'll be finding that out over the coming weeks, I'd say.
Hannah Walsh is our reporter in Longreach. Hannah, thanks so much for bringing us up to date here on Australia Wide.
Thanks.
A regular mammogram can be the first line of defence against breast cancer, but women in regional Queensland are waiting 4 to 9 months for diagnostic mammograms compared to 3 to 4 weeks in metropolitan areas. As Nikki Sorbello reports, it has experts and patients concerned.
Wait times for mammograms are a national problem and they're just not acceptable. What we're seeing is that the more remote you're living, the longer you take to be seen.
Chris Kane is the CEO of the Australian Diagnostic Imaging Association.
In metropolitan areas, we're seeing that women are typically waiting 3 or 4 weeks or more. That's not something to celebrate, but it's a much better outcome than what we see in regional Queensland, where if mammography is available at all, patients are typically waiting between 4 and 9 months. Queensland isn't an outlier. We see this problem throughout the country.
It's something that caught Maxine Austin off guard.
I've got close relatives that have double mastectomies, so I'm one of those people that need to keep having that exam to make sure that I'm okay. I was basically told I couldn't make an appointment until mid next year. Now I don't have an appointment. I don't know when I'm going to get my regular mammography.
Ms. Austin lives in Queensland's Wide Bay, which has the highest mortality rate from any cancer in regional and remote Queensland, as well as the highest rate of breast cancer, as reported by the Chief Health Officer in 2022. Wait times at the free screening service, Breast Screen Queensland, are shorter, generally up to 4 weeks in the Wide Bay. But the service is only available to women over 40 who don't have any symptoms or need a diagnostic ultrasound. Vicky Durston, the Director of Policy, Advocacy and Support Services at Breast Cancer Network Australia, says private diagnostic imaging needs as many resources as the Breast Screen program.
We know behaviourally that women don't always prioritise their own health and their own needs first and foremost. So when we see barriers for women to be able to access screening and prevention and all of these preventative health needs, it can delay things. And the problem for what we see is that if there are delays, then breast cancers will not be picked up early.
Mr. Kane said the wait times were potentially tragic.
We know that for women with aggressive tumours, waiting for months could be the difference between treatable disease and metastatic malignancy. That's potentially the difference between life and death.
The problem, he says, is years of underfunding.
The Medicare rebates for breast imaging were set several decades ago, and then radiology had a 22-year rebate freeze between 1998 and 2020. Mammography is a loss maker, so it isn't viable to provide it everywhere because of how low the rebates are. And second, there just aren't enough radiologists choosing to specialise in breast imaging because it's so underfunded.
But Naomi Gibson, the Australasian Society of Medical Imaging and Radiation Technology president, says there are other factors as well.
Medical radiation sciences includes up to 56 weeks of clinical placement. Currently, we have quite a concerning statistic of up to 25% of our students currently in university courses actually experience financial hardship because of this burden of clinical placement where they have to go to other towns, other sites, and they're expected to live. And with the cost of living and that, they can't maintain paying for life in two different locations. So up to 25% of our current students are delaying their studies or looking to actually drop out.
A spokesperson for the Federal Department of Health, Disability and Ageing said the department was currently undertaking a review of Medicare-funded diagnostic breast imaging services, which included the structure of items and fees. Mr. Kane says the organisation is calling on the federal government to significantly increase the Medicare funding.
This isn't a niche service. It's essential service for the diagnosis of the most common cancer for women.
Nikki Sorbello with that report. Now, do you consider yourself a cricket fan? How about heading to all 5 Ashes tests this summer? Well, how about driving all across Australia on a small yellow Vespa to do that? That's the story of 55-year-old Scott Stokes, who is traversing 1,200 kilometres of the country, all for the love of the sport. But as Broken Hill reporter Bill Orman discovered, it's not all about cricket.
It's a counter-attacking 100 from the makeshift opener. He salutes the pavilion.
One of tens of thousands of cricket lovers watching Travis Head score his thrilling test century in Perth was Scott Stokes.
Everyone's on their feet, really.
The 55-year-old from Canberra, who maintains he has no relation to English cricket captain Ben Stokes, is on a mission to attend every test on his little yellow Vespa named Vanespa. But for Scott Stokes, the journey is about more than just cricket. After battling mental illness, he was medically retired several years ago. And this trip is another test of sorts.
Love for cricket, first and foremost. Always been a dream of mine to go to every day of every Ashes test, both here and in England, in fact. But the other reason's a bit tougher question, which is it's a mental health journey. Had a fairly significant event at the end of 2020, and I've become sort of medically retired as a result of it. Didn't go well a few years ago. And I bought Vanespa just after being retired. She is really great to ride. It's very good for mindfulness. And I've been feeling better. And so I thought, well, I floated the idea with my wife, Helen. And I was like, well, I could ride Vanespa to all the Ashes tests.
And when Helen Stokes didn't say no, Scott took it as a green light and got planning, armed with a detailed spreadsheet of petrol stations for refuelling to combat the limited mileage of the Vespa. Scott set off for Perth and is now 8,000 kilometres later in Brisbane for the second test.
It's a bit of a dance, to be honest, because I'm only going 90 and they're ploughing along pretty fast, and I have to be very mindful of where they are, trying to pull over to the left as much as possible and let them go past. But there is a bit of drafting and sort of wind that happens, and there's been occasions where I've sort of felt myself sort of being sucked in a little bit and had to be really, really mindful of the trucks. Yeah, there's been a couple of close calls, which my wife won't want to hear about.
The long journey culminating in the realisation of Scott's dream to attend every Ashes test in a series has given him a target and a goal, as his wife Helen explains.
The Vespa's been really kind of life-changing for him. So he's definitely doing everything he can to rebuild his resilience, which has certainly been low in recent years. So we're about 5 years into this journey now, and it's tough on the kids. Tough on me, tough on him, tough on his family, but he's working really hard to do what he can to get better, I guess, and you've got to admire that.
While Helen and the rest of the family are completely behind Scott's marathon journey, she did firmly rule out a his and hers matching dual Vespa scenario.
No, I can't even ride on it yet because he's on his P plate, so until April next year, I can't even be a passenger. So no, I'm not very coordinated, so we don't want me on the open roads on a Vespa. I think I'll just, can go on the back of his every now and then.
From Brisbane, Scott and Vanespa, his little yellow Vespa, will make their way southbound to Adelaide, then on to Melbourne via the Great Ocean Road and up to Sydney, and finally back home to Canberra. For the remaining month or so of cricket, Scott's hoping to see Australia win the Ashes, along with some tough competitive cricket.
Bill Ormond reporting there. And finally here on Australia Wide. A country music legend, a TV presenter and a former administrator of the Northern Territory, Ted Egan has died in Alice Springs at the age of 93, surrounded by his family. In terms of country music, he's a Golden Guitar winner, he's an inaugural life member of the Australian Stockman's Hall of Fame, and has a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Golden Guitar Awards, and produced 30 albums during his career. Musician Matt Scullion spoke to Darwin reporter Matt Bran about the extraordinary life of his good friend Ted Egan.
I've lived a long and blessed life, travelled this great wide land, in all its colours, met people of renown.
Absolutely heartbroken. It's funny, I was just writing, I'm just halfway through trying to write a post to put up on my social media and just trying to find the right words to say. I really don't know if there is any words. I will say, but that I'm so glad that I went out of my way to go to Alice Springs last year, and so I've written a song called Beer Box Man about Ted, and my wife and I went up there, and we went up there and spent three beautiful days with Ted, and he even took us for a drive in his old Land Cruiser, you know, at 92 years old. You know, I'm just really glad that I got to spend that little bit of time with him. I spoke with him a couple of weeks ago because I knew that he was ill, and just had a really quick chat, and I had a feeling then that it was going to be my last time I spoke to him. Look, just really sad, but at the same time, you know, Ted had a wonderful life. He would be saying, don't feel sad for me, you know. He really did squeeze every bit of juice out of life, and I'm pretty sure that he didn't die with any regrets.
An extraordinary life. So many chapters to it.
His music is such a small part of it. I got to know him through his music and then found out all these amazing other things about him, all the other the people he helped and the legacy he left, and, you know, you know, helping out the, like he was so passionate about the Indigenous people of this country, you know, and so much that he did for them and to bring awareness to different issues and the wonderful books that he wrote for kids to teach people about Australia and about this, you know, like our history and school teacher, so many different things, a park ranger up in Arnhem Land. He was a champion footballer too, you know. And he was the first one that ever brought Tiwi Islanders over to play in the competition in Darwin with a few other people, but he was one of the first to do that. There's so many layers to his life. I don't know, full up inside from knowing him, if that makes any sense.
Matt Scullion paying tribute to his friend Ted Egan, who has died at the age of 93. And that is Australia Wide. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.